withdraw its forces from their country. The U.S. Attorney General appoints a special counsel to investigate financial and business dealings of President Biden's son. Also coming up, China slams the U.S. for frequently violating the World Trade Organization rules and damaging the interests of other member states. Welcome. Our top story this hour, anti-France sentiments fast growing across the Sahel region. Thousands of people have rallied near a French military base in Kouhit, Niger, calling for the withdrawal of French forces. Protesters on the outskirts of the capital, Niamey, shouted down with France and down with ECOWAS. They said that the West African regional bloc isn't independent and is being manipulated by France. ECOWAS leaders have approved the deployment of a standby force in their efforts to reinstate Niger's deposed pro-Western leader. And France has pledged to give its full support to all the conclusions of the West African leaders. Former colonial power France currently has around 1,500 personnel in Niger. That's its last outpost in the Sahel region after being forced to withdraw troops from Mali and Burkina Faso in the wake of military coups since 2020. A leaked classified document shows that the U.S. pushed for the removal of former Pakistani Prime Minister Imran Khan last year. U.S.-based news outlet The Intercept says it has obtained the document from an anonymous source in the Pakistani military. It says State Department officials used threats and promises to push for Imran Khan's removal over his stance on the Ukraine war.
The U.S. publication has obtained a classified document suggesting Washington pushed for the removal of former Pakistani Prime Minister Imran Khan from office. The document has been published by The Intercept. According to the secret cable known internally as a cipher, a meeting took place on March 7, 2022, between the Pakistani ambassador to the U.S., Asad Majid Khan, and two State Department officials. During the meeting, U.S. officials, including the Assistant Secretary of State for the Bureau of South and Central Asian Affairs, Donald Liu, encouraged the Pakistani government to remove Imran Khan over his neutrality over the war in Ukraine. The day before the meeting, Khan addressed a rally and responded directly to European calls that Pakistan rally behind Ukraine. During that rally, Khan said Pakistanis were not slaves to the Europeans and Americans. He said, "We are friends of Russia, and we are also friends of the U.S. We are friends of China and Europe. We are not part of any alliance." 1 month after the meeting with U.S. officials, a no-confidence vote was held in Parliament, leading to Khan's removal from power. The vote is believed to have been organized with the backing of Pakistan's powerful military. The cable reveals both the carrots and the sticks that the State Department deployed in its push against Khan, U.S. officials promising warmer relations if Khan was removed. They also threatened Pakistan with isolation if Khan was not removed from power. The diplomatic meeting came 2 weeks after the war began between Russia and Ukraine. Before his ouster, Khan had already accused a quote foreign power of funding a conspiracy to topple his democratically elected government.
So I get this message. Donald Liu is telling the ambassador that unless I, Imran Khan, is removed as the prime minister in the no-confidence motion, there'll be consequences for Pakistan. It was a conspiracy. It was the army chief. It was the guy who's the prime minister right now. And the U.S. came into it as thinking as I'm someone anti-American. Some reason, if you don't agree with the U.S. foreign policy, you're turned anti-American. First, worry about your own people rather than getting involved in conflicts.
Khan has been suspended from politics for 5 years. He has also been sentenced to 3 years in prison on graft charges, which he has dismissed. Khan has now lodged legal challenges against his conviction. He was arrested in Lahore at the weekend.
The unnamed foreign power was interpreted as a clear reference to the U.S. Following Khan's ouster from power, Pakistan plunged into a crisis. He was elected in July 2018, promising to fight corruption and to fix the economy. But those pledges went unmet, and the world's second-largest Muslim country was gripped by a financial crisis. After Khan's removal, his supporters took to the streets across Pakistan to show their support for the removed prime minister. Since his removal from power, about 200 court cases have been lodged against Khan by the military-backed government.
All my time is spent from going from one court to another courtroom. I have made, in 2 months, over 150 court appearances. And my legal team is busy fending off one case after the other. But the thing is, nothing sticks, because these are frivolous, bogus cases. And what now they are planning to do is to have military courts. And this is right now in the Supreme Court, whether the courts will allow military courts or not. And the objective of the military court is that there I certainly will be sentenced.
The former prime minister has maintained that the cases against him are politically motivated to keep him out of power. He says the country's powerful military is behind these cases. Khan has been barred from holding public office for 5 years by the country's electoral authorities. The decision was announced by the Election Commission of Pakistan days after Khan was sentenced to 3 years in prison for corruption. Under Pakistani laws, a convicted person cannot run for public office for a period set out by the Election Commission of Pakistan.
The recent premature decision by the Election Commission of Pakistan is just another method for this unmandated government to try to eliminate Imran Khan from the political landscape of Pakistan. We must remember that Imran Khan was, is, and always will remain the chairman of Pakistan Tehreek-e-Insaf, the largest national level party in the country. Imran Khan's case against him from a session court will be reversed.
Khan is not the first Pakistani prime minister to be convicted of alleged corruption. It is believed the political system in Pakistan is widely mired in corruption, and none of the politicians and political parties have shown any desire to fix the system. On Thursday, Pakistan's parliament was dissolved on the recommendation of Prime Minister Shehbaz Sharif, making way for a general election amid political and economic crises. But the vote could be delayed several months, with the Election Commission set to start redrawing hundreds of constituencies based on a fresh consensus. Analysts have said any delay in the election could fuel public anger and add to uncertainty in the cash-strapped country.
Moving on, an Iranian parliamentary delegation is in Beirut to hold talks with Lebanese lawmakers and other Lebanese and Palestinian figures. The delegation is led by the head of the National Security and Foreign Policy Commission of Iran's parliament. Our correspondent, Maryam Saleh, has the details.
Head of the Iranian Parliament's National Security and Foreign Policy Commission, Vahid Jalalzadeh, is leading a parliamentary delegation to Beirut for talks with top officials. The first significant meeting was with Lebanese Parliament Speaker Nabi Hibiri. During their talks, Jalalzadeh stressed that the meeting was a chance to discuss the latest developments and express Iran's support for Lebanon.
It was an opportunity for us to reiterate the official stance of the Islamic Republic of Iran. We stand by Lebanon, both in its resistance against the Israeli regime and its struggle to overcome the country's economic hardships.
The delegation also met with representatives of the Palestinian factions in Lebanon and discussed the latest developments in Palestine, especially the occupied West Bank.
In this meeting, we discussed the Palestinian resistance and the deterrent power in the face of the Zionist entity, as well as the resistance operations which are increasing in the West Bank. Both the Palestinian and Lebanese factions underlined the significant role of the Islamic Republic of Iran in their resistance against the Israeli regime. We received guarantees that Iran's support for the Palestinian people will continue until the full liberation of the occupied territories.
The Islamic Republic of Iran has been steadfast in its support of the Palestinian cause since it was founded. This is a strategic stance adapted by the Islamic Republic, and the Palestinian people and resistance movements understand this. Iran's support has been fruitful in the West Bank, and it will eventually lead to the liberation of Palestine and other occupied Arab territories.
The Lebanese Foreign Affairs Parliamentary Committee met with the Iranian delegation and welcomed the visit as part of efforts to boost Tehran-Beirut ties.
And it was a good opportunity also to share what we do as a Foreign Affairs Committee in the Parliament and what kind of issues we deal with. So again, it's a very mutual and important visit that we'd like to build upon with all our friends, given our need for this support from all over.
The Iranian parliamentary delegation arrived to Beirut from Damascus and met with all Palestinian factions here in Lebanon. They have reiterated to the Lebanese and the Palestinians that their support is unwavering in assisting the people of the region to confront the U.S. Zionist prevalent threats. Maryam Saleh, Beirut.
To the occupied West Bank now, where a funeral has been held for another Palestinian killed by Israeli forces. Mourners in the city of Tulkarm chanted slogans demanding the ramping up of resistance against Israel. Mahmoud Jarrad succumbed to a gunshot wound in the chest, which he sustained during an Israeli raid on a refugee camp on the city. The incursion also left at least eight other Palestinians wounded. The Hamas resistance movement stressed that resistance will continue unabated, vowing that Israel's crimes will not go unpunished. Meanwhile, four Palestinians have been wounded during an Israeli regime forces attacks on protesters in the town of Kfar Qaddoum. Israeli troops carry out attacks against Palestinian towns and cities across the West Bank almost on a daily basis. Our correspondent Rama Lamuna Kandil says a general strike has been declared in Tulkarm to mourn the young Palestinian killed by Israeli forces.
Today, a general strike and a day of mourning has been declared in the city of Tulkarm as well as in the refugee camp of Tulkarm for the killing of Mahmoud Jarrad. Over 215 Palestinians had been killed by the Israeli forces since the beginning of this year, including 40 children, 40 Palestinian minors, and 18 Palestinian women had been killed by the Israeli forces and the Israeli settlers. The crimes and the aggression of the Israeli military continues every day. The day after the Friday prayers, Palestinians carried out anti-Israeli protests in several areas in the occupied West Bank, in Tulkarm, in Nablus, in areas around Ramallah, to tell the Israeli authorities that they will not remain silent for the confiscation of their land, for the building of the illegal settlements. And as usual, the Israeli forces attacked the people, used the stun grenades and tear gas, as well as rubber-coated bullets in order to disperse the Palestinians.
Palestinians have rallied in the besieged Gaza Strip to condemn escalating Israeli violations against the Al-Aqsa Mosque. They also expressed support for the resistance movement in the occupied West Bank. Our correspondent Ashraf Shannon has more in this report from Gaza.
People rallied in the Gaza Strip following Friday prayers in solidarity with Al-Quds and Al-Aqsa Mosque. Palestinians decried the Israeli crimes in Al-Quds and in the occupied West Bank. In recent weeks, settlers backed by Israeli forces have repeatedly violated the sanctity of Al-Quds. Israeli forces also carry out daily attacks in the occupied West Bank. They have killed some 200 Palestinians since the beginning of this year. Palestinian resistance movement Hamas, which organized the rally, warned the Israeli regime of the consequences of violations in Al-Quds and in the occupied West Bank.
The Palestinian people and the resistance are closely monitoring the aggression of the Zionist regime against Al-Quds and Al-Aqsa Mosque. We will not sit idly by while extremist settlers desecrate Al-Aqsa Mosque, and we're willing to sacrifice our lives for it. The resistance will intensify, and Israeli crimes in the occupied West Bank will not go unpunished.
Palestinians maintain that continued Israeli violations against Al-Aqsa Mosque will only lead to more resistance against the occupation.
Israeli policies in Al-Quds are aimed at ethnically cleansing Palestinians and turning Al-Aqsa Mosque into a Jewish temple. As we rally today, we call on all Muslims to defend Al-Quds because it belongs to all Muslims and Arabs.
For decades, Al-Quds has been at the core of the Palestinian struggle for justice and freedom.
We came out today to support Al-Aqsa Mosque and the resistance in the occupied West Bank.
Al-Quds is in our heart, and we will always fight for the sake of Al-Quds. Al-Quds needs real action from all Muslims in order to protect it.
Al-Aqsa Mosque is Islam's third holiest site and has been under Israeli occupation since 1967, while Palestinians consider Al-Quds as the capital of their future state.
Palestinians in the besieged coastal territory say that they will use all forms of resistance against the Israeli occupation until the liberation of Al-Quds. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
Moving on, U.S. Attorney General Merrick Garland has appointed a special counsel in the Hunter Biden probe, deepening the investigation of the president's son. Ahead of the 2024 election, the special counsel is a Delaware attorney who has been probing the financial and business dealings of Hunter Biden since 2019. This expands the attorney's authority and independence to conduct a more sweeping investigation. Under the current investigation, Hunter Biden faces criminal tax and gun charges, but a federal judge has refused to accept a proposed plea deal. The attorney now says Hunter Biden may be headed for a criminal trial. Now, China says the U.S. frequently breaches the World Trade Organization rules and obligations and damages the shared interests of its members. China's Ministry of Commerce made this statement in its first report on U.S. compliance with WTO commitments. The ministry said the U.S. has been pursuing an America First policy for 6 years at the expense of other countries. It cited Washington's abuse of export control and sanctions to hinder other countries' development. The report referred to a vast array of U.S. self-serving actions, such as the blocking of appointments to the WTO appellate body, which led to its paralysis. China also noted that the U.S. is selectively implementing rulings of WTO's dispute settlement body. China's Ministry of Commerce said the report aims to urge the U.S. to shoulder its responsibilities and safeguard the multilateral trading system. That brings an end to World News for this hour. Thank you for staying tuned.
Imam Ja'far Sadiq, peace be upon him, has said, "Whoever remembers us to Ahlul Bayt and his or her eyes fills with tears, his or her face will never burn in the fire of hell."
Thank you.
the unique jihad of Imam Zainul Abidin, peace upon him. In the name of God, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Salam, dear listeners, and condolences to you on a doleful day. The 25th of Muharram is the day on which the survivor of the heart-rending tragedy of Karbala, Imam Zainul Abidin, peace upon him, attained martyrdom because of a fatal dose of poisoning in the year 95 AH, 34 years after the tragic martyrdom of his father, Imam Hussein, peace upon him. Before we present you a feature on the great-grandson and fourth infallible heir of Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny, here is a passage worth contemplating upon. Woe to you, O son of Adam! You're negligent, but not neglected. Your death is a hastiest to you. It is approaching you with sure steps. It is targeting you and is about to hit you, and you will soon take your age in full. The angel of death seizes your soul, and you will be alone in your grave. There, your soul will be given back to you, and the two angels, namely Munkar and Nakir, will enter your grave to examine and interrogate you. The passage which we recited to you now is indeed food for thought. It reminds us of our eventual fate, even if we were to live for over 100 years, because death is decreed for every living thing. Death, however, is not the end of existence, especially of the human soul. It is the path to barzakh, or the intermediary period in afterlife, before resurrection of the physical body on the day of judgment for the final fate. In other words, it is the passage traversed by all and could be called the bridge to either the eternal bliss of paradise or the eternal damnation of hell. That is the reason the two angels interrogate every person immediately after death. Barzakh, of course, has its own state of prosperity and perfidy. The All-Merciful God has made it a period of grace for mankind, where rewards could be increased, faults could be forgiven or commuted, depending on the good works a person may have left behind, or anything good done on his life, behalf by offspring and friends. These words of certitude were spoken by a person who, in a matter of a few hours, had seen his brothers, uncles, cousins, friends, and finally father gloriously court death in armed combat with the forces of evil, rather than give it to the illegal demands of an illegitimate regime. The reason he himself did not meet death on the day of Ashura, 61 AH, was because of the fact he was severely sick and bedridden, and thus unable to enter the battlefield for armed jihad. Divine providence had, however, kept him for another kind of jihad, which he so admirably performed that to this day he is known as Zainul Abidin, or Ornament of the Sincere Worshippers of the One and Only God. We'll be right back.
Born in the year 38 AH in Medina to the virtuous lady Princess Shahrbanu of Persia, that is Iran, and named Ali by his father, Imam Hussein, peace upon him, in honor of his own father, the commander of the faithful, Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib, peace upon him, he was a youth of 23 years on the fateful day of Ashura in Karbala, when almost all male members of the Prophet's household were massacred by the bloodthirsty Umayyad hordes. On the equally tragic evening of 10th of Muharram, 61 AH, he was taken prisoner by the Umayyad army, along with his wife, small son, sisters, young cousins, and aunts, including Hazrat Zainab, peace upon her, the indomitable granddaughter of the Prophet of Islam. On the day following the blood-curdling tragedy, he had a brush with death when it seemed his soul would depart from his body. As he motionlessly watched the dismembered and unburied corpse of his father, Imam Hussein, peace upon him, but could not do anything since he was bound with chains and fetters. He lamented his helplessness to his aunt, who soothed and consoled him, for he was chosen by God for carrying the battle to the enemy camp. Thus started a novel way of jihad for Imam Zainul Abidin, peace upon him, that would soon rock the court of the tyrant Yazid in Damascus, where his sermons before audiences, which included the Byzantine Christian ambassador, unnerved the self-styled caliph and made him release the Ahlul Bayt from bondage in the Syrian capital. For 34 years, Imam Zainul Abidin, peace upon him, as the fourth infallible successor of Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny, held aloft the torch of guidance as caliphs rose and fell in Damascus, while in Hejaz, the impostor Abdullah ibn Zubayr made life torturous for the Prophet's household for 10 long years, from 63 AH to 73 AH, even once attempting to burn alive all male members of the Hashemite clan. His supplications in the divine court and his munajat, or whispered prayers, are indeed a treasure trove of wisdom that strengthens faith through proper cognizance of God Almighty and His infinite mercy, as well as matters pertaining to the wonders of creation, such as the weight of light, which were unthinkable those days and which modern science is beginning to discover in our own times with the help of technology and electronic gadgets. The fourth Imam was, however, no ascetic, and when the regime in Damascus was helpless in the face of pressures from the Byzantine Empire regarding supply of coins that were stamped with emblems of the Christian creed, he sent his son and eventual successor, Imam Muhammad Baqir, peace upon him, to Syria to give the necessary advice and make arrangements for setting up of the first ever mint in the Islamic realm, thus saving the faith of the Muslims and the drain of the bullion. In 95 AH, the survivor of the tragedy of Karbala was eventually martyred through poisoning by the wretch Walid ibn Abdul Malik, who masqueraded as caliph in Damascus. The fourth imam left the mortal world, but not before ensuring that the pure and pristine legacy of the Prophet passed to his son, Imam Muhammad Baqir, peace upon him, and after him to his grandson, Imam Ja'far Sadiq, peace upon him, who was 12 years old at the time of death of his grandfather. He was laid to rest in the sacred Jannatul Baqi cemetery in the holy Medina, besides his uncle and father-in-law, Imam Hassan Mujtaba, peace upon him. Today, the Wahhabi heretics may have desecrated and destroyed his tomb, along with that of his son, grandson, and uncle, but they have utterly failed in distracting people from the glorious teachings of the Ahlul Bayt on how to live a life of faith and die with dignity for earning the bliss of the hereafter. No wonder. Among the immortal legacies of the fourth imam is the prayer supplication manual, Sahifatu Sajjadiyah, and the treatise on rights titled Risalatul Huquq, which modern scholars consider more perfect than the UN Charter of Human Rights, since it embodies each and every right, including the right of our own bodily organs upon ourselves. Before bidding you farewell, we present you a passage from this remarkable work on the proper use of our own tongue, which is vital for a speech. The right of the tongue is that you consider it too noble for obscenity. Accustom it to good. Refrain from any meddling in which there is nothing to be gained. Express kindness to the people and speak well concerning them.
Joining us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Hello and welcome to Spotlight. The Iranian Foreign Ministry says the process to unblock the nation's several billion dollar assets illegally frozen by the U.S. has kicked off. Iran's Deputy Foreign Minister Ali Bagheri-Khani says that Tehran has received guarantees for Washington's commitment to its obligations. According to the Iranian official, the release of several Iranians who were illegally detained in the United States under the pretext of bypassing U.S. sanctions also comes in this context. Several Iranian-Americans convicted in Iran on spying charges are also expected to be released once the U.S. implements its commitments. The Iranian officials have already announced that Tehran is open to prisoner exchange talks with the U.S. out of respect for humanitarian issues. Joining us on Spotlight, we have Professor at University of Tehran and political analyst Mr. Fouad Yezadi, who's joining us from the Iranian capital, Tehran. And anti-war activist and member of the Answer Coalition, Richard Becker, is joining us from San Francisco.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Gentlemen, welcome to the program. Let's start off with Professor Izadi in Tehran. Iran's assets that were frozen in South Korea due to U.S. sanctions are to be released. What is your analysis on this development?
Well, as you correctly stated, the sanctions are illegal. We have the U.S. Congress blocking money that belongs to the Iranian people. It's a violation of the nuclear agreement. As you know, the nuclear agreement was codified in UN Resolution 2231. United States left the agreement during the Trump administration, and Biden refuses to return to the agreement and implements all the sanctions that are out there passed by the U.S. Congress against Iran. That's why they're illegal. Not following UN resolutions is illegal. U.S. is a member of the permanent five, the P5 countries that are in the Security Council, permanent members of the Security Council. The U.S. is not only not following the UN resolution, they are punishing countries that want to follow UN resolution, including South Korea. They are violating other countries' sovereignty. That's a very basic right that countries have to decide to do what is best for them. So the U.S. is telling South Korean companies that they need to follow U.S. Congress's sanctions and rules and regulations. And that's violating South Korea's sovereignty. That's violating other countries' sovereignty that want to have economic trade with Iran. So returning these funds to Iran under severe restrictions is not a big achievement for the United States. So what the U.S. is doing is that they engage in espionage against Iran all the time. They blow up places in Iran with the help of Israelis sometimes on their own. And when these people are caught, they get them back through blockading Iranian money. That's how they operate when it comes to their operations in Iran. And obviously, the Raisi administration is interested in this money, and they go along with this setup. But this doesn't make what the U.S. is doing correct.
Richard Becker, the U.S. has imposed rounds of unilateral sanctions against Iran over its nuclear energy program. In your opinion, can this new development be seen as yet another indication that the U.S. maximum pressure has not been successful against Iran?
I think that the sanctions against Iran, like the sanctions against Cuba, Venezuela, North Korea, and numerous other countries, are causing great suffering among the populations. This is particularly true for smaller countries, which have the very limited ability to meet all the needs to produce everything that's needed and the best variety of goods and commodities that are needed in modern society. They're causing great suffering. They're not succeeding. As your other guest indicated, I think that the what we see happening right now in regard to Iran is after Trump did withdrew from the JCPOA, illegally withdrew from it. Biden continues their policy, so and imposing more and more sanctions. So it is causing suffering among the people, but it's not succeeding. And it's not going to succeed. And you can see, you know, I would cite one difference is that, you know, an important difference is that 70 years ago this year, I believe it was 70 years ago this year, the sanctions, the blockade that was imposed, the embargo of Iranian oil on the world market imposed by the British and the United States did lead to played a critical role in the overthrow of the Mossadegh government at that time. That's not happening here. That clearly is not happening in regard to Iran. The sanctions are not bringing down the government or causing harm, but they're not causing the kind of harm that's going to bring about the regime change that Washington is seeking.
Professor Izadi, despite Iran's commitment to the 2015 nuclear deal, as mentioned by you and our guest in San Francisco, the U.S. unilaterally withdrew from the JCPOA, then reimposed basically sanctions on Tehran. That's why Tehran says Washington's not trustworthy. Iran, in this case, says it has received guarantees from Washington's commitment to its obligations this time. Unpack that issue for us, the trustworthy of the United States when it comes to signing deals.
You know, Richard Becker a minute ago talked about Mohammad Mossadegh's government and the 1953 coup d'etat in Iran. This year makes the 70th anniversary of that coup d'etat. And the Iranian people have learned the fact that the United States is a hostile power. Not only Iranians inside Iran, we have five Iranians that are jailed in the United States for, they're accused of violating the sanctions that are illegal. And they are generally victims of FBI fishing expeditions, putting people in situations where they can be placed under arrest and put in jail, generally for political reasons more than anything else. So these type of hostilities have been with us from the United States for many decades. And as was correctly said, Iran is not allowed. We have many countries, Cuba, Nicaragua, Venezuela, in Latin America, other countries in Africa, in Asia, in other continents that are victims of U.S. Imperialism and aggression. The good news is that this type of policies generally backfire. And the reason we don't have an American embassy in Tehran today is because out of the U.S. embassy, we had the 1953 coup, and the Iranian people are not going to allow that to happen again. So overall, I think all the attempts to put pressure on the Iranian people with the hope of people putting pressure on the government and engaging in some sort of color revolution, the U.S. policies have resulted in Iran not only surviving, but becoming stronger in comparison to what we had before. And that's the result of the misguided and short-sighted policies that we see from Washington.
Richard Becker, there were years of accusations that Iran was seeking to build a nuclear weapon. Then the JCPOA deal, which resulted in inspections and et cetera, that came along. Then the U.S. pulled out of the deal. Why should the U.S. Be trusted? Iran is right to ask for assurances when the U.S. has shown that it can't be trusted, even when it does sign deals.
Yeah, and, I don't like to say it, and I don't say it because I'm a supporter of Biden, but, there's a very good possibility that Trump will return to the presidency. So I think that, that underlines the importance of there being some kind of assurance, binding insurance given to Iran in regard to a return to the JCPOA if that were to happen. And I'm not saying that it's going to, but there certainly is a great cause given, the U.S. put the Shah on the throne, and I don't think this is like forgotten. I mean, millions of Iranians are alive today who, people of my age and even younger who can remember that what the Shah's regime was like and how it served the interests of the U.S. and the royal family and a very thin layer at the top, but imposed great suffering on on the Iranian people, and that was coming from the U.S. embassy. That was coming from Washington. The support for the Shah and the hailing of the Shah, even by liberals like Jimmy Carter. So, yes, given that history and given the more recent history of the abandonment, the walking away from JCPOA, there certainly is a great cause for the Iranian side to demand a binding agreement, not to overturn a new agreement were there to be one.
Professor Izadi, despite claims made by the U.S. Treasury in the past that the sanctions on Iran don't apply to transactions for the provision of agricultural commodities, food, medicine, or medical devices to Iran, even Europeans in this case have asserted that the U.S. sanctions have dire humanitarian consequences. The U.S. has a tendency to target ordinary citizens with its sanctions, doesn't it?
And they do, not only Iranians that are in jail in the United States, but nationals of many other countries that are put under sanctions because of trading with Iran or working with Iran on economic issues. The United States basically bullies other countries, other companies that belong to other countries, and prevents them from working with Iran. They say that food and medicine is exempt from sanctions, but in practice, because of banking sanctions and banking restrictions, Iran is not able to engage in these type of activities, even when Iran has the money, because the money cannot be transferred to the companies because of the sanctions, banking sanctions from the United States. And even in this current deal that we are talking about, they say it's going to take about a month for it to go through because of all the complications that the United States has when it comes to money transfer that belongs to Iran. So even when U.S. government officials decide to engage in some sort of agreement with Iran, they cannot do it given the fact that this web of sanctions around Iran that they created is causing so much difficulties. So we don't have to go back to 1953 to see what the U.S. is doing to the Iranian people. We have people that don't have access to the medicine that they want. Iran makes more than 90% of the medicine that the country needs internally, but for certain type of medicines, Iran has to import, and there are difficulties in this type of trade because of U.S. sanctions. So people are suffering, and some people are dying because of what the Biden administration has decided to do, to continue the failed policies of the Trump administration.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Richard Becker, Iranian President Ebrahim Raisi has insisted many times that the country will not abandon the negotiating table, but will also refuse to bow down to excessive demands that violate its national interests. The president believes that the U.S. sanctions against Iran are unjust and Washington needs to remove them. Given all we've discussed tonight, where do you believe the U.S. stands on any future negotiations, most notably the issue of sanctions removal?
Well, first of all, let me say that, as your other guest stated, the idea of that food and medicine are being excluded from this is a false idea, a completely false idea, that somehow there's a humanitarian avenue for countries that are under sanction. No, it's not true. For one thing, the point about Iran produces a great deal of medicine and a great variety of medicine, but there are certain medicines that are only produced in the United States or by U.S. companies that are, in many cases, life-saving medicine, like medicines for that can treat and cure leukemia among young children. Very hard to get, very expensive, and not available and not produced almost by anywhere by the U.S. or the U.S. and its allies. So, and I know this too. I was in Iraq twice during the sanctions on Iraq, and Iraq was a far less developed country than Iran, of course. And so it wasn't able to produce that kind of medicine. So there, when I went first in 1994, after 3.5 years, there was virtually no medicine in the hospitals. People were not going to the hospitals anymore, only to die. Families would be there with their children who were dying of, very treatable diseases. So, you know, that's a point of great hypocrisy when they say that this point about food and medicine being excluded. And the extraterritoriality that your other guest mentioned is very important. This is illegal. This is interference in the affairs and the sovereignty of countries all over the world. They are the sanctions are imposed upon them as well, in the sense that if they continue to trade with Iran or with Cuba or with Venezuela or Nicaragua or any of the countries that are sanctioned, their companies, their banks, their governments can suffer enormous economic consequences, financial consequences because of that. So I think these are important points to make. And I think that it is a sense of encouragement that countries are resisting and resisting very strongly against this and trying to find a way past it. But we must keep in mind the suffering that this is imposing on the population of much of the world.
And Professor Izadi, one last question for you. What are the underlying reasons, in your opinion, for the decades of U.S. animosity towards Iran and its anti-Iran policies?
You know, one would assume it's the 1979 revolution and the fact that the new government deposed of a U.S. puppet in Iran. But I don't think that's a complete answer, because the animosity started well before 1979. It started when the United States decided to cooperate with the UK to organize that coup in Iran. And that's the type of animosity we have been experiencing for the last 70 years. And the fact that Iran is able to survive and progress is another issue that's causing difficulties in Washington, because you're not supposed to do that. You're supposed to accept the sanctions and then listen to the dictates that are coming from Washington. But if you're doing what Iran is doing, then you have to suffer more. The good news is the United States is a country in decline. So this type of suffering will end sooner or later.
All right. Thanks a lot, gentlemen. Professor Fouad Izadi joining us from the Iranian capital, Tehran, and Mr. Richard Beckard from the Answer Coalition joining us from San Francisco. Thank you for your comments and contributing to this program, and a special thanks for staying with us on tonight's Spotlight.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily round the clock for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, shortwave, FM, and satellite. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 25 meters, 11,645 kilohertz, every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 megahertz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Iran Sat or Bat 5 and Intelsat 39 and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
This is Foresight. A program on how to worship Allah. Today's great tip: how do we cut ourselves from this rat race in order to be able to increase, enhance, and strengthen our ubudiyah, our service, our worship, and our obedience to the Almighty Allah? So, dear listeners, we are talking about how we are going to have to detach ourselves from this rat race, this machine race that we live in order to be able to increase, level up, and enhance our ubudiyah, our service, our worship, and our obedience to the Almighty Allah. Now, dear friends, of course, we know that we live in a world which is technologically advanced, it's scientifically advanced. One of the unintended consequences of this technological advancement, of course, is that we seem to be stuck in this machine-like race. The capitalistic systems and even the communist systems, these kind of man-made economic financial systems, they are not made in order to cater to the spiritual needs and the spiritual development of a human being. The main purpose is the creation of wealth, the generation of wealth, and then the distribution of wealth. That's all that matters. If we want to put it very frankly, the only thing that is important is wealth. Now, how that wealth is generated and how that wealth is distributed, those are pretty much the differentiating factors between the capitalist economic system and the communist economic system. In neither system do we find that there is any